So, hello everyone. Thanks for the invitation to this colloquium, and I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person. I would have loved to meet you all in person, but here we are on Zoom, and I hope the talk is just as exciting as an in-person one. What I'm going to talk about today is a new development in atmospheric characterization of low-mass temperate exoplanets, especially focusing on potentially habitable exoplanets. And that's where this this Hyshin paradigm comes in. And this is really trying to ask the question, what is practically possible with current facilities in terms of atmospheric observations of habitable planets, and what are the prospects for detecting, you know, potential biomarker molecules in such atmospheres? So that's the remit of this talk. As a big picture, philosophically speaking, traditionally, whenever we talked about habitability or the search for life, the general concept has been we want to detect. The holy grail is that we want to detect an Earth-like planet around a sun-like star and detect a biomarker in its atmosphere. So that, and no one would argue with that. Ultimately, we want an Earth twin with a biomarker. But then we want to ask the more practical questions. What exactly do we need in terms of astronomical observations for that to be a reality? So there are two obvious requirements for a biosignature detection. One is that we ought to be able to detect a true Earth twin, obviously. And we want the observational capability to detect an atmospheric biosignature in its atmosphere. I'm not going into technosignatures or SETI type searches. I'm asking for the minimal requirement of some atmospheric feature. Both of these things, as of right now, are not possible with current facilities. Okay, we do not have an exact Earth twin just yet. In other words, an Earth-like planet around a sun-like star. Currently, we don't know of such a planet. There are close twins. There are Earth-like planets around habitable zones of smaller stars that we know of. So that's fine. But exact Earth twin, we haven't found. And even amongst the planets that we do know of, the habitable planets, not all of them are conducive for atmospheric observations. Okay, and I'll come to that a little bit more in a couple of slides. And then there is the question of observational capability of biosignature detection, assuming we have an Earth twin. So let's say we have found an Earth twin today. The question is, do we have the observational capability to detect an atmospheric signature? Any atmospheric signature, let alone a biomarker detection, with current facilities? And the answer to that also is close to no. And the reason for that is that if you take the Earth around a sun-like star, just the ratio of the sizes, the contrast basically, be it the size contrast or the flux contrast, is too small for current facilities, including JWST, to be able to detect a biosignature with a reasonable amount of time investment. So those are two fundamental challenges. So if we stick to our canonical goal of a biosignature detection in an Earth twin, then that is currently not feasible. This is why you will hear a new upcoming planned facilities like the Habitable Worlds Observatory and the ELTs and so on. The reason for that is when we have those facilities, the HWO, for example, in the next, you know, between or order 15, 20 years, those would be, their goal would be to detect such biosignatures if we have Earth-like planets, Earth twins. Okay. But then what do we do currently? And that is the question that I would like to focus on in this entire talk. One clue is that between Earth and Neptune in the solar system. So if you take the size range of the solar system planets, there is Earth and smaller planets, which are the terrestrial planets. And the next size is of Uranus and Neptune, both of which are four times larger than Earth. Okay, so, and between those two ranges, there are basically no other planets known currently in the solar system. And that regime is what is known as the sub-Neptune regime. So these are planets between Earth and Neptune in size. The question, and in the current exoplanet population, we know tons of these planets. In fact, the current known exoplanet population is dominated by planets in the sub-Neptune regime. Okay. So then the question is, which of these planets, these currently known exoplanets that are potentially habitable, which of them are conducive for atmospheric observations, and what are possible biomarkers in their atmospheres, if at all they are habitable, what are those possible biomarkers that may be detectable with current facilities? So these are the pertinent questions in the field currently on this domain, like in terms of habitability and biomarker detections. So this is the outline of my talk. First, I'll give a broad overview of what the canonical understanding is of planetary habitability, exoplanet habitability. And then I'll introduce the Hyacinth paradigm, which basically expands and accelerates the search for habitable environments and life elsewhere. And then I'll talk about biosignatures and the detectability in such planets. And I'll talk about an observational case study with a planet called K2-18b, and then I'll discuss the future outlook. So in this talk, you're going to get basically the theoretical underpinnings of habitability and new developments, and we'll see some observational tests that have just happened in the past year, basically. So in terms of exoplanet habitability, this is a very famous and common diagram of the habitable zone, a very traditional one. This is a cartoon from several, based on arguments from Kasten et al. 1993, but there have been some modifications in recent years as well. But the habitable zone is basically defined as the region around a star, where if you put an Earth-like planet around it, at that location, it can have liquid water on the surface. So it's a simple definition. You take Earth, you put it around a star, and see what are the distances over which that planet can host liquid water on the surface. So that's the habitable zone. So for a sun-like star, that habitable zone lies somewhere between Earth and it does cover Mars as well. However, if the star is smaller, we also know that the star will be cooler because the temperature goes as mass roughly. So cooler stars are smaller stars are also cooler, which means the habitable zone will be closer to the star. In other words, you can be closer to the star and still have roughly the same irradiation and hence the same equilibrium temperature for the planet. Conversely,
just to clarify one thing about this, like is this band making some assumption about the strength of the greenhouse effect? Like you're assuming that it's the same as the Earth?
Yes. Yeah, okay. So the conditions are assumed to be similar to that of Earth. So you literally put Earth around a star and see how far you can be and have similar greenhouse effect.
Okay, but more generally, I mean, you know, the strength of the greenhouse effect, you know, varies.
Yeah, you change the atmospheric composition, you can change many other properties, you can change the albedo of the atmosphere, and this varies. And actually, there are other papers that do that. So you have a bit of variation in the habitable zone. But I'm just talking about a classical definition. In fact, we'll use that exact point that you mentioned by replacing the atmosphere with a hydrogen-rich atmosphere and see what it does to the habitable zone.
Okay,
great. So that's literally what we are going to do. So that was our canonical definition of a habitable zone. With various assumptions motivated by the Earth. And based on that definition, today we know a few dozens of habitable planets around other stars. There are various databases that are compiled which compile planets like the habitable planets like these. But what you'll notice is that most of these planets are radial loss to planets, which means the planets are not transiting. Whereas for atmospheric observations, most of the observational capabilities that we have today are for transiting planets, are conducive for transiting planets. There are ways which in which atmospheres can also be observed for non-transiting planets, but those are harder. Okay. So dozens of planets, habitable, potentially habitable planets known, not so many which are transiting and hence conducive for atmospheric characterization. I'll drive the same point home with this plot here. This is showing the planet population in the radius period plane on the left, and on the right, it's the radius and equilibrium temperature, which is the effective irradiation received by the planet and in equilibrium, an average estimate of it in temperature. And you'll find that there are well over 5,000 planets known today, discovered by various facilities, Kepler tests, ground-based facilities, and so on. Most of these are giant planets, large planets, and hot planets. Okay, so close. So if you see this temperature plot, you'll see that most of these are very hot, are not habitable, and giant planets as well. If I put a cut here at roughly habitable temperatures, let's say 300 Kelvin or order 20 degrees, then you see that there are not that many planets to the left of this line here. But then we say we want literally Earth-like planets that are habitable, then you'll see that the population dwindles further. Okay, so in these 5,000 plus planets that we know so far, by the way, 5,000 is including radial velocity, but if you look at just transiting planets, it's less. It's still several thousand planets. But even within those, there are only a handful of planets that are Earth size or smaller. Okay, just a handful. And then if I put a box around it, all the planets Earth or smaller, there are literally three or four planets that are Earth size or smaller that are potentially observable with transits. That is not a hard limit. Rocky planets, if you go to higher masses, can also be slightly larger in size. So in principle, you can go up to about 1.5 Earth radius and still be rocky. And so in that sense, there are several more planets, order 10 planets, that are potentially habitable and transiting and can be rocky. But not all of them are equally conducive for atmospheric observations in the sense that it is not enough for your planet to be transiting. The star also needs to be bright enough to have the right signal to noise to allow for this transit observer for the atmospheric spectroscopy. One of the textbook examples of a good habitable system is the TRAPPIST-1 system. Some of you may have heard about this. This is a system where there are four planets in the habitable zone around a very small star, an M dwarf. Okay. And all of these planets are in principle, their atmospheres are observed and they're transiting. They're all transiting. So in principle, their atmospheres are observable with JWST, albeit with a significant investment of JWST time. We are talking about order 100 hours to get a robust detection of if we want, let's say, an ozone feature, it'll take more than 100 hours to get a robust detection. Arguably more than that, because the star, for other aspects, because the star is very active and you don't get clean transits all the time, but we won't go into those details. Suffice it to say that there are a handful of, sorry, question? Was there a question? Sorry.
Was there a question in the time room? Sorry.
No, I heard, I thought there was a question.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe not. All right.
So in principle, there are a few of these planets that are transiting and in the habitable zone that are roughly Earth size, 1.2 or so on, but that's still difficult. But a new frontier has opened up in the last few years, actually, which is what the sub-Neptune regime is that I hinted at earlier, which is that planets between Earth and Neptune, this is just again showing this radius period diagram. This is a Kepler sample. observed with the Kepler Space Telescope a while ago, but drives home the point that between Earth and Neptune in size is where this planet population dominates. And there are several other missions that are happening right now, like TESS and KEOPS, that are observing more and more of these sub-Neptunes around nearby stars, which make them conducive for atmospheric observations. At the same time, both HST and JWST are facilities that are conducive for making atmospheric observations of these really nearby sub-Neptunes and detect atmospheric features. And we'll see a case study of that. So if you take a histogram again, this is just showing a pictorial a distribution of radii of the same similar population, which is that the planets in the sub-Neptune regime dominate the exoplanet population. I won't go into further details. There is substructure in it, which answers other questions on planet formation and so on. But it's a rich landscape, the sub-Neptune regime. So for our purpose, the pertinent question is, well, we have seen that traditional notions of habitability were restricted to Earth-like planets, but we have not that many planets of Earth size that we can characterize their atmospheres with current facilities. So then we ask the alternate question, and what are the limits on planet mass, radius, and temperature for habitability? Where this is coming from is, you saw this plot I showed before, in that if we were focused just on Earth-like planets, the numbers are limited. But if we can push more in that direction, if we can make the planets larger and still remain habitable, then we have several more, many more targets that open up for atmospheric characterization. Right, so then it becomes a theoretical question on, well, where do you put that cut on habitability? How big can a planet be? How massive, how large, how hot can a planet be and still remain habitable? Because the bigger and hotter you go, the more planets you have for these observations. So that is really this question that we are asking here. And that is what brings us to the Hyacinthe paradigm. So what I'll walk you through is a case study which motivated this whole direction of study in the last 3 years. So the story starts with the sub-Neptune K218b, which was discovered in the middle of the last decade. It's a planet that is about 9 times Earth mass and about 2.5 times Earth radius. But the insulation it receives from its star is similar to what we have on Earth, although it's still only on a 33-day orbit around its star. And the reason for that is that the star is a small star. It's an M dwarf. Okay? It's roughly half the size of the sun. So it's cooler as well, around 3500 Kelvin, which means your planet can be at significantly shorter orbital periods or shorter orbital separations and still have Earth-like insulation. So the equilibrium temperature is between 250 to 300 Kelvin, depending on the albedo. So here we have a significantly larger planet than on Earth, but receives similar irradiation as the Earth. Then the question we wanted to ask is this planet actually habitable? Now, such planets don't, as I said already, they don't have any analog in the solar system. It lies between Earth and Neptune in size. So we were curious as to what the prospects are for habitability. Our curiosity was also driven by the fact that in 2019, two groups had reported detection of a spectral feature in the atmosphere of this planet using transit spectroscopy. So this is just the absorption depth of the transit, and I'll come back to transit spectroscopy in a bit. But this is just a what is known as a transmission spectrum or an absorption spectrum, the size ratio squared of the planet to star over wavelength, and you see this little blip here. And that's what was used at that time to claim that this was a water vapor absorption. But there were other studies which argued that maybe it could be due to methane, because methane also has a feature at similar wavelengths, so there was that degeneracy. Or it could be due to star spots in the star, obviously, because cooler regions of the star will also have water vapor absorption features, which could mimic the spectral signature of the planet. And okay, so there are all these complications. So with one feature detected with Hubble, we weren't sure that that was a robust feature. And we ourselves actually did the same exercise and also found that, you know, if you do a proper atmospheric retrieval, we also found that, yes, that could be explained by water. There was an upper limit on methane, which means those are degenerate, and so on. But what was clear from this is that if it is a feature, whether due to H2O or methane, then the atmosphere has to be a hydrogen-dominated atmosphere with small amounts of water vapor or some other molecule. And that was important, is that now we have a hydrogen-rich atmosphere that we have established, and we know the size of the planet, we know the mass of the planet, so we can go ahead and try to put some constraints on the internal structure of the planet, however degenerate. And that's what we did, actually. So this is showing the mass and radius of the planet at, known at the time. And again, I won't go into detail on internal structure models here. Suffice it to say that these curves you're seeing are curves of homogeneous composition. In other words, if you just have a ball of iron, a sphere of iron, how would its radius vary as a function of mass? It's a very simple setup. You basically solve your hydrostatic equilibrium and mass continuity equations, and given the equation of state of the material, you can come up with, you can solve those equations in a simple manner. So that's what pure iron, pure silicate, pure water is shown in blue. And what we found is that this planet, the mass and radius of the planet, in other words, the density, the mass and radius are higher, or the density is lower than any of these compositions, okay? Which means even a pure H2O interior won't be able to explain the density of the planet as it stood then, which means it needs a hydrogen-rich atmosphere of some kind, which is consistent with what we are seeing from the atmospheric observation. Other than that, there are any number of combinations of the interior that are possible. It's a degenerate problem, right? Because you have only two observables, which is the mass and radius, but you have multiple internal structures, constituents, the iron, silicate, and water that you can mix and match, and hydrogen, actually. So you have four interior compositions possible, constituents, to explain that density. So what we established is that it's a degenerate set of solutions. As shown here, it could be a purely rocky world with a large hydrogen atmosphere. It could be a mini Neptune, which is similar to Neptune but smaller, which is have a rocky core, a water mantle or icy mantle, and a reasonable hydrogen envelope. On the other hand, it can also be another extreme, which is a water world, which is predominantly water, let's say 99% water, and a very thin layer of hydrogen. Okay. So these are three cases shown here with the constituent mass fractions, and those pertain to these three scenarios. Okay. Very small hydrogen layer in the last case, okay. Less than 0.01%, 90% water, and so on. So it is a degenerate problem. So nothing much could be said about the specifics. However, two important results came out of this exercise. One is that this was the first time a coupled atmosphere interior modeling approach was even possible for a planet where you have an atmospheric detection and you know the bulk mass and radius accurately. So for the first time, we can put those observations together and put constraints on both the atmospheric and interior composition, however degenerate. At least in principle, we showed that that should be doable. Okay. And then we also know that in the atmosphere, there are many free parameters, right? There are clouds and hazes, in other words, albedos that will make a difference to the temperature structure. There is infrared opacity, which is a molecular composition. There is internal flux. There is the stellar irradiation. All of these things matter. So it is a degenerate problem, but in principle, we have mapped out the space, the model space that can be explored in search of these solutions, number one. Another important thing that came from this exercise is that because we are doing this coupled modeling of the atmosphere and interior, we can also explore the space of possible temperatures and pressures at the interface between the surface and between the atmosphere and the interior, which is the boundary. And what we showed is that these are different for various model assumptions. These are the red curves here show the loci of the boundary between the hydrogen and water layer. H2H2O boundary is what that HHB stands for. So at that surface, what are the pressures and temperatures? So this is the pressure temperature space. And this is just showing the space of the loci of all those points of the boundary. In the background is shown the water phase diagram. And the summary of this plot is to say that amongst all the possible solutions that we had, a small number of solutions, a small fraction, do lie in the liquid phase. In other words, this is on the right, on the right here is showing an example for a certain albedo assumption for certain properties of hazes and composition of the atmosphere and so on. We could demonstrate that you could, in principle, have a liquid water ocean under the hydrogen-rich atmosphere. It is a degenerate problem, but in principle, it is possible to have that. And that, to us, was the smoking gun. Okay. So we took that as a cue, as an example, and tried to explore the full space of possible atmospheric conditions, you know, different haze properties, different, in other words, different albedos, different interior temperatures, irradiation, and so on. And basically, we showed that in general, you should be able to come up with a subset of this atmospheric parameter space, which allows for liquid water at the bottom of a hydrogen-rich atmosphere in such planets. There are counterexamples as well, which is if you don't have enough of an albedo, you can also show that it's very hard to get a liquid water surface. It'll always be boiling the water and too hot for habitability. So again, two summary statements came out of all this work is that one is that it demonstrated a holistic approach where you could take observations and in principle put constraints on atmospheres and interior conditions, and then it opened a new avenue to study planetary habitability, because if this planet can be 2.5 times Earth radius and have a small subset of solutions that are habitable, we were wondering, well, what is the full space of such planets? What are the full range of possible radii, masses, temperatures that can allow for habitable conditions? And that's where this this new regime of Hessian worlds came in. And the upshot of that entire exploration was that in the mass radius plane, there is a significant region of this mass radius plane that allows for similar conditions as we found for K2-18b. In all of these cases, you can have habitable like oceans underneath the hydrogen-rich atmosphere. So the word Hessian stands for, is a portmanteau of hydrogen and ocean. So hydrogen-rich atmospheres on ocean-covered surfaces are what these planets would be characterized by. So this blue region is showing this Hessian plane, and there are various other nuances which I won't go into detail. Suffice it to say that depending on the star that this planet, such planets orbit, one can go up to 400 plus temperatures and still remain habitable. The atmospheres can remain habitable. Now, we saw this as our classical habitable zone for reference. And when you do these calculations, similar calculations for Hessian planets, what we see is that these temperature structures can be very different for Hessian planets depending on the stellar type. So you can see that for very low temperature stars, so low mass stars at 2500, these are late M dwarfs. You can go above 400 Kelvin and still remain habitable at the boundary, liquid water at the boundary. So you saw the terrestrial habitable zone in the previous slide, and now we find that the habitable zone is significantly expanded for these Hessian conditions, and the outer limit is actually indefinite. And that other studies have shown for rocky planets before, that you can actually be in outer space without the star at all and still be habitable because hydrogen is such a good greenhouse gas, and so on and so forth. So we also came up, again, in the interest of time, I won't go into these details, but we also came up with concepts of, let's say dark Hessian world where only the base, where the planet is obviously tightly locked if it's closer in. But the day side won't be habitable, it'll be too hot, but there would be a permanent night side, which could still have liquid water oceans on the surface. So those would be the dark Hessians in the sense that they would have a permanent dark side that is habitable. And then on the other extreme, you would have cold Hessian worlds, which would be extremely cold throughout, but the temperatures will be lot lower in the atmosphere. But the hydrogen layer means that just the surface will be liquid and the atmosphere would be freezing. So there would be no water detected in the atmosphere, but the surface would have water. So that's the other extreme. So I won't go into these details. These are just fun concepts to think about. If you like the theory of these objects, please read this paper. So I'll move on to our last part of the talk. So in that paper, we predicted that there are about a dozen planets around nearby M dwarfs that could be candidate Haitian worlds that we can look at with JWST. From then on, there were several other studies in the field which also showed that if you have a liquid surface or a solid surface, as opposed to a Neptune-like deep hydrogen-rich atmosphere, there are also chemical observables that can be used to establish the presence of a surface. And we'll revisit this later on in the talk. I'm just seeding the idea that it's not just the atmosphere and mass and radius constraints. In principle, the composition of the atmosphere can also allow us to infer if there is an ocean underneath. So we'll revisit this in a second. We'll revisit this flowchart in a second, but this is just from earlier this year, actually, before our observations. We tried to come up with a flowchart on how to identify a Haitian planet purely chemically based on these various markers, water vapor, methane, ammonia, and so on. Okay, so in interest of time, I'll zoom through biosignatures. I realize I'm running low on time here. So the question for biomarkers is, if you look at an Earth-like atmosphere, what are the kinds of molecules that we plan to detect to establish the presence of life? The common answer you'll get is typically oxygen, ozone, nitrous oxide, methane. That combination is a robust combination to establish the presence of life on an Earth-like planet. There are false positives for any individual molecule, like oxygen and ozone do have false positives. In other words, they can be created in other mechanisms, with mechanisms other than life. Same with methane. Nitrous oxide is more robust, doesn't have that many false positives. But by and large, those are the prominent biomarkers. On the other hand, there are many secondary biomarkers like dimethyl sulfide, methyl fluoride, and so on, which are known to be robust biomarkers on Earth. In other words, there are no significant abiotic sources for several of these species. The downside is that they're produced in small quantities that are too small to be detectable. We're talking about part per billion or lower, right? Very small quantities. Turns out, in a hydrogen-rich atmosphere, because the atmospheric signature will be so much better because of the hydrogen-rich nature, the low mean molecular rate, the secondary biomarkers become more detectable. So people have done these sorts of simulations. These are just showing the cross-sections of these various molecules I just talked about to show that all of them are active in the infrared. So if you have a good infrared telescope, all of these should be in principle detectable. More importantly, people have done these calculations that if you have a hydrogen-rich atmosphere, because the atmosphere will be light, low mean molecular weight, a number of these molecules will be more readily detectable than if they were in a Earth-like atmosphere, like nitrogen-rich atmosphere, which would be heavier. Okay, so with JWST, this is where JWST comes in, because if we look at transit spectroscopy, the spectrum, the transit depth, is basically the ratio of the planet to star radius squared, the ratio of the areas. And these are some of the first observations with JWST for a hot Jupiter. People have already detected molecules like carbon dioxide, water vapor, and so on. And the signal to noise is spectacular, as expected for giant planets. This is a giant planet, a Saturn size, a Saturn mass planet, a Jupiter size. Now, if you do that same exercise for a biosignature detection in a rocky planet, so these are for the TRAPPIST planets, roughly Earth-sized planets, what people have found is that we need several tens of transits in a Earth-sized planet around a late M dwarf, so very small star, but still one needs tens of transits to detect ozone. Okay, these sorts of numbers translate to order 100 hours or more of JWST time if you want to detect a biosignature. One could, in principle, invest that if one is ambitious, but there are other problems that we are that are coming to fore right now, is that maybe the planets don't have atmospheres at all because they're around a very active M dwarf, in which case, you know, the detection would be even harder. The star is also very active, which makes it even more challenging to detect. If we do the same exercise for these Haitian candidates that I mentioned before, these are simulations that we did a few years ago in the same paper. We showed that in principle with several transits, and we're talking order tens of hours with JWST, we should be able to detect the secondary biomarkers I talked about, this dimethyl sulfide, methyl chloride, and so on. And these are just showing three of the promising Haitian candidates, which means they're around bright nearby M dwarfs, and the planet size star size contrast is such that you can see many of these features of prominent molecules like water, methane, and so on by eye. So this is what the promise that JWST brings in characterizing these sorts of objects. So in the last part of my talk, I'm going to talk about an actual case study with JWST of a Haitian candidate. This was the first such observation that has been reported so far. So again, this is the planet that we already talked about, and we already talked about the HST spectrum that was seen in 2019. And just to refresh your memory, we saw that, you know, if we believe that feature, then we know that it's a hydrogen-rich atmosphere, but it wasn't clear whether it was due to methane or water vapor or methane. There was discussion in the field, and there was also degeneracies with other features. So that was the state of the art up until earlier this year, actually. And just to refresh your memory, we also said that there was degeneracy in the interior composition. There were all these scenarios that were possible. So we proposed for a JWST program to look at, this was cycle one program, to obtain three transits with JWST in three different instruments, NIRIS, NIRSPEC, and MIRI, to span around the 1 to 8 micron. In principle, the observations go beyond 8 micron, but this sensitivity drops. So we were proposing that we would get a very good spectrum between 1 to 8 micron and see if we can detect at least the prominent molecular features. The goal was not necessarily to be able to detect biomarkers. We wanted to at least take the first observations and see if we can detect anything at all, okay, in terms of the broad molecular compositions, along with possible trace compounds like carbon monoxide, potentially CO2, and so on. So these are just some observational characteristics. So far, we had only obtained two of those three observations, one with NIRIS, one with NIRSPEC. Together, those cover the 1 to 5 micron range, NIRIS going from roughly 1 to 2.8, NIRSPEC going from 2.7 to 5.2 microns. Each of those transits took about 5 hours. And the observations were as standard as you can imagine with the JWST observation. They were pretty standard. Okay, so there were no surprises, very clean observations, which I'm going to show you shortly. And this is just showing a summary of the data reduction, light curve analysis, and so on for the observers in the room. Now, so this is showing the spectrum of the NIRSPEC G395H grating on the 2D plane, on the detector. And this is showing the white light curve, which is the entire spectrum, the entire light binned into just one band. And this is the transit. Okay, so you can see the amazing data quality of JWST that we are seeing at average precision of 100 parts per million, which is remarkable at this resolution. So this is with the other instrument. Again, this is a slightly more difficult observation to make because the NIRIS source is a slitless spectrograph. For those of you who are interested in observations, it's non-trivial to extract the spectrum from this sort of from this sort of spectrum, because you'll see that the orders overlap. So we have to be careful about disentangling the odors, and there is a lot of background contamination that needs to be corrected for, and so on. But again, pretty standard procedure in the field. So now I'm about to reveal to you what the actual spectrum looks like after all that data reduction and analysis is said and done. So this was the HST spectrum that we saw before. And let's see what the JWST spectrum looks like. Now, to give you a sense of scale here, so this HST spectrum was obtained with 8 transits, all in the HST band and well above 60 plus hours of HST time, along with these two points of photometric points with Spitzer, and this is one with Tess and so on. And this is entire spectrum, and the feature you see is between 1 to 1.1 to 1.8 micron. But this entire spectrum from 1 to 5 micron is obtained with only 14 hours of JWST time. So that should give you a sense of scale of how spectacular the instruments are. This is just one transit with each instrument, nearest, near spec. So this entire range was spanned with just 14 hours. And in here, you can see 5 peaks of molecular features, and these are all due to methane, like across the board. So there are 5 peaks here, all due to methane. I'll come to the interpretation in a second. You also see this peak here, which is due to carbon dioxide. So on and so forth. But the broad takeaway just from the observation, irrespective of the interpretation, is the spectacular data quality and the promise that JWST is already delivering is that for small planets around M dwarfs, it is finally feasible to detect spectral features like this. Okay, so that was the takeaway.
So can I ask a basic question? Sorry.
Yeah.
Is it surprising to have both carbon dioxide and also methane like at the same time?
Yes. That's what I'm coming to.
Okay.
That's exactly the point. That's a very strong sign of chemical disequilibrium already. And this is showing just a contribution plot just to demonstrate that a lot of these features are features from methane. And a feature here is due to CO2. And there is also, you'll see I've marked here DMS, which got a lot of attention, but it's a very tentative inference that we have. And the reason DMS is also important is because it's got an overlapping feature. This peak you see here is both methane and DMS have features there. So when you do extract this information, the chemical information from a higher resolution spectrum, from the native resolution spectrum, we do see contributions from DMS buried in this peak as well. Okay, and same here, DMS also has features across this range. So those features are being picked up by the atmospheric retrieval that we are doing. What happens in a retrieval is that we take the data at native resolution, not the binned data that I showed you. This is RF a few thousand in the near spec band. And then there is a parametric model, an atmospheric model with all the composition, the molecular abundances as free parameters, and we do the radiative transfer and so on. And then we run it through a parameter estimation scheme that the cosmologists in the room would be very familiar with. We use the same tools, in this particular case, nested sampling with multi-nest with order 20 free parameters, which take care of all the molecular abundances, temperature profiles, cloud parameters, and so on, and we get the posteriors. If you look at the posteriors, you see a very clear peak due to methane. These are all abundances of various molecular species in the model, and we get a very clear peak due to methane. That is at a 5 sigma detection significance. We see a very clear peak due to CO2. That's at a 3 sigma detection significance. And we see also a peak for DMS, but the posterior starts to have significant tails, depends on how we introduce offsets between the data sets. So if we assume that the data are accurate at face value, then we get a good constraint on DMS. This is still like at only 2 plus sigma. We're still not like super robust, but 2 sigma-ish. But then the moment we start introducing offsets between the instruments or within the near spec instrument, you know, there are multiple sub detectors, so to speak. If we introduce offset between those, then we start to reduce the detection significance. We see these tails. But those of you familiar with posteriors would still notice that the peak doesn't go away, even if you introduce the offsets. So the peak still remains roughly where it was, but the posteriors, you know, the tails get more and more significant. On the other hand, there are other molecules like water vapor, ammonia, HCN, and so on, for which there are genuine non-detections. There, we just don't see them at all, okay, regardless. Now, methane and CO2 are molecules that are expected under chemical equilibrium, but DMS is a biomarker on Earth, and that is what garnered so much attention for this. We have been careful in the paper to outline that it's only 2 sigma and the detection significance goes away when you introduce enough offset. So it's not a very robust robust claim at all, but that's what we get out of the data. And there could be some other molecules which we may not have considered, so it may go away tomorrow, but this is where it stands right now. So the summary of this whole story is that we find enormous amounts of methane and CO2, order 1% each. We see also enormous amount of DMS. That's a lot compared to Earth-like concentrations, but also depending on the offsets, the tails are huge. So, and the detection significance goes away. So we are not certain about that just yet, but we are also not seeing water vapor or ammonia. Now, what does all this tell us? So this is just summarizing what I've just mentioned. But the detections of methane and carbon dioxide and the non-detections of these species are already telling us about the potential presence of an ocean under a hydrogen-rich atmosphere. Remember, I hinted at this plot before. I said I'll come back to it. So when you have a deep hydrogen-rich atmosphere like Neptune in the solar system, for example, and it is cold, like Earth-like temperatures, 200, 300 Kelvin temperatures, what you expect is a lot of the carbon to be in methane and a lot of the nitrogen to be in ammonia. And those are the molecules that are formed under equilibrium or disequilibrium because the temperatures are so low. But if you're seeing methane and if you don't see ammonia, that is telling that something is not right in the sense that the atmosphere is no longer deep. Both of these molecules can, in principle, be destroyed photochemically in the upper atmosphere. But if you have a deep hydrogen-rich atmosphere, they can also be recycled very efficiently from the lower atmosphere. But what happens when you put a surface is that recycling is cut off. So then ammonia, because it is very soluble in a ocean, in water, effectively, it gets lost very quickly. So there have been studies, predictions before, in the last couple of years, showing that if you see methane and CO2, and if you don't see ammonia, that is an indicator of an ocean surface. And that exactly is what the observations are finding. And so one inference that we can come up with this combination is that the amounts of CO2 and methane we are seeing and the non-detection of ammonia is what is indicating the presence of an ocean. There may be another process that we don't know of so far, an atmospheric process that can also explain it. But based on current atmospheric chemistry, this is what we can infer. Again, I mentioned about this flowchart where we effectively said the same thing, is that if you have water vapor, then that could be an indicator of an ocean. But if you're not seeing water vapor, you want to ask if the temperature is low enough for the water to condense out. And the constraints that we're getting also from the atmospheric observations are consistent with that. So the idea is that the atmosphere is at low enough temperature that water is condensing out as it happens in Earth's atmosphere as well. If you go high enough in the stratosphere, actually it's quite dry. And then if you have methane and if you have molecules like CO2, but if you don't have molecule like ammonia, that combination, the only way we can explain it based on all the atmospheric chemistry we know of so far, is if it has a thin hydrogen-rich atmosphere and an ocean surface underneath. Okay, so that's the summary of these latest observations, is that these are literally the first detections of carbon-based molecules in a habitable zone exoplanet. So even if I said we have detected methane in this atmosphere, that itself is a big breakthrough in the field because methane has never been detected in an exoplanet this cold ever. So this resolves the long-standing, what is known as the missing methane problem in temperate exoplanets. We have been looking at it for methane with HST, Spitzer, and so on for more than a decade, and we never found it. And with JWST, with one observation, we get it immediately. And then everything else is on top of it. So you get this combination of methane and CO2, and non-detection of ammonia are consistent with predictions for a Haitian world, for an ocean surface underneath a thin hydrogen-rich atmosphere. We also have a potential inference of dimethyl sulfide, which is a possible biomarker on Earth. Obviously, more observations are required to robustly prove or disprove its presence, but also more modeling is required to establish that actually there is no other chemical process that can produce DMS in such an atmosphere. So we need to establish that to establish the possibility of biological activity in the planet. Beyond all of the detections and non-detections, the summary takeaway from this is that these observations, the very first JWST observations of this planet, open the pathway to being able to characterize Haitian worlds with JWST, which is a big deal in and of itself. So the Haitian worlds, currently this new paradigm is expanding and accelerating the search for life as it stands. And we have over a dozen planets that can be looked at with JWST, and there are several observations coming over the next year, which will look at both K2-18b and other Haitian candidates, which would basically open up a new era in exoplanet science in terms of characterizing atmospheres and habitable zone exoplanets. Okay, so that was our NASA press release for the finding in September. And where this leaves us, as far as the future outlook is concerned, is that over 200 hours of JWST time has already been allocated in cycles 1 and 2 for nearby Haitian candidates. So we will hear more about several Haitian candidate observations over the coming year. And then we also now have developed the framework, the theoretical framework, to be able to interpret these observations with this coupled modeling of the atmosphere and interior. And the promise of this decade is that it is arguably our first encounter ever as a species in detecting atmospheric signatures of habitable zone exoplanets, period, right? So this decade, what present theory and observations are showing us is that this decade could be that decade which would serve as the launch pad in the search for life in exoplanetary atmosphere. So we have the James Webb, but we also have the ELTs coming on ground, and we have the planets, which is the most important thing. You can have all the facilities if you want, but if you don't have the planets, it's not going to work. So, but the good news here is that we have over a dozen planets around nearby stars that we can look at, and there are more coming with these surveys like TESS and a lot of ground-based efforts. So this is looking like a very promising decade to look out for. So watch this space. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Madhu. Yes, let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his great talk.
Thank you.
Okay, yes. So any questions for our speaker? Well, so I can start off maybe. I mean, well, so I still just wanted to understand this question about the simultaneous presence of both CO2 and also methane. So were there models, you were finding that had both simultaneously?
So that needs chemical disequilibrium in the sense that the CO2, you can get that combination. If you had a deep atmosphere, then there are ways to get it by increasing the metallicity, for example. If you increase the metallicity to very high in the atmosphere, you can in principle get both methane, because there's a lot of carbon and oxygen around, you can still get methane and CO2. But the real catch is the absence of ammonia means that it can't just be a metallicity effect. So the argument there is that the presence of an ocean is both cutting the ammonia, but can also act as a supplier of the CO2 itself. And so the CO2 from a formation point of view, CO2 can be dissolved in the ocean as well as be in equilibrium with the CO2 in the atmosphere. So that's the argument there.
Okay. I think I see.
But if you had just a solar composition, hydrogen-rich atmosphere, you wouldn't expect that much CO2.
Yes, what I thought. Okay, I see.
Exactly.
Okay.
So you would expect, like in the solar system, giant planets, you'd expect methane, you'd expect ammonia, but not much else in terms of CO2 or CO. But the disequilibrium is changing that equation.
All right, got it. Thanks so much. Asunyayesh, go ahead.
Thank you. Very, very nice talk and exciting results. So I just wanted to kind of get an idea about where you see things going, say, in, 10, 20, 30 years. When are we going to be confident that we detected life, basically? What are the things that you want to see to kind of confidently say you've seen life outside solar system?
It's a very to the point and difficult question. there are multiple camps on this. Like, you know, some people would argue that even if you saw ozone or oxygen on a Earth-like planet around another star, we can't be sure if there is life, right? Because you usually want two or three different molecules which cannot be explained by any other process. So that's the big picture. Mm-hmm. If you are talking about Earth-like planets around Sun-like stars, for that we will have to wait, I would say, at least two decades to be able to until the next generation of facilities come up and so on, at least 1 to 2 decades. These Haitian worlds are a different game. Here, I can afford to be bullish in the sense that just based on our theoretical predictions and observational facility that we have now, JWST and what we are seeing, purely based on that, we have already predicted that we should be able to detect multiple biomarkers like DMS if they're actually present, if there is actually life on these planets, and we have about a dozen targets, we do deep observations. Then if there is life, if those molecules are there, we ought to be able to detect them within the next 5 years. If we invest the JWST time that is needed. There are order 5 planets for which some JWST observations will already happen in the next 1 or 2 years. So we'll have the first smoking gun type answers already. If there are some indications of any of these biomarkers, we should see, like we saw in K2-18b, it'll be a 2 sigma or less result of that type with the very initial observations. And then you want to follow them up and so on. So if you put in enough JWST time, I would think 5 years, we would be able to see multiple biomarkers if they're present in this atmosphere. So it's not an observational challenge. It is possible. Of course, if they're not there, then you won't find them. So that's a different matter. But we are talking about 5 to 10 year time frame for detection of multiple biomarkers robustly if we put in the time. So it's up to the community to take that call.
Perfect. Thank you.
So Ralph had his hand up next.
Yes, Nico, that was an exciting talk. I wanted to just ask the question about hydrogen cyanide, because we know that hydrogen cyanide is a vital feedstock molecule for a true biomolecules. And I noticed that your models had significant amounts of hydrogen cyanide available. Could you comment a little bit on the hydrogen cyanide abundances, detectability or not, and how
hydrogen? Hydrogen HCN is detectable, but we are not finding it in the current observations. HCN is a very good prebiotic molecule, but for as a feedstock for life, for forming life, it is a very good molecule, but it is also not guaranteed to be present billions of years after life has formed and equilibrated to present day. So it could be detected, but the observational sensitivity is there. If we have HCN at order 10 parts per million, that could be detectable, but we are not seeing it. I think you're muted, Rolf, can't hear you.
Could it have been, can it be washed, rained out very easily? That is, you know, in a as the ammonia is?
Yeah, so it could also, it could also be dissolved in the ocean or rained out somehow. But there are destruction mechanisms for HCN, basically. So these chemical models show that HCN can be depleted in the presence of an ocean.
Thank you.
So I think Ryan.
So next, Ryan had his hand up.
Absolutely. Echoing the other audience members, Nico, thank you very much for the great talk and the exciting results indeed. I'm trying to understand your flow chart of going from the Hycene candidate down to a bona fide Hycene world. And there's this curious step of getting past the lack of water, because of course, water, you sort of expect water. And so the argument there is the low temperature. So am I to understand that loop in the flow chart as being at those low temperatures in a chemical equilibrium state, you don't expect to see water over methane? Or is it just that even at the high pressures of the surface of the ocean atmospheric layer, you'd expect any water vapor to actually condense out?
No, for a significant, I would say for about a scale height or so above the ocean, you would still have water vapor. It's just that the observations, when you do this transit spectroscopy, what you're probing is the upper atmosphere. The deepest you probe is about 10 to 100 millibar. So about 0.1 bar is the maximum depth you probe. But obviously, the ocean surface can be at 10 bar. Or even 1 bar would be deeper, which means we are not seeing that part of the atmosphere. So the water can, in principle, be present in the lower atmosphere. It's just that where we are probing in the upper atmosphere, the atmosphere would be quite dry if the temperature is low. And the same happens in the Earth's atmosphere. If you go into the stratosphere, for example, the Earth's the water vapor abundance plummets by more than an order of magnitude. So it's that kind of effect. Now, there is an observable diagnostic of that particular effect, actually. So you brought up a really good point. Now, K2-18b is about the coolest Hycene within one or it's one of only two Hycene candidates that are that cold. There are other Hycene candidates which are hotter, which means there you could expect to see water vapor as well, in addition to methane and CO2. Right, so if you did these observations for a range of planets with different temperatures, that can give you a diagnostic, an observable diagnostic of that loop that you identified.
But it is a thermochemical effect as opposed to something like, of course, around these M dwarfs, we expect them to be XUV active for many hundreds of millions of years, giga years even. It's not a photochemical effect.
No, I would think it's more a condensation effect. Because if it's photochemical, methane would be destroyed before water.
Okay.
Right. So methane is very fragile as well photochemically, and it could as well be destroyed, but it is being replenished potentially somehow. But if methane is present, CO2 is present, there is no reason why water shouldn't be present. So that's the argument for the thermochemical channel.
Great. Thank you.
So Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, so thanks for the talk. At various points, you kind of used a phrase, the caveat, that sort of to the extent that we currently understand atmospheric chemistry. And I was just curious, is that sort of unknown unknowns where, who knows? Or is it rather that there's sort of things that in the near future we're going to get resolution about through observations and through better theoretical models? So I guess it, what's the path forward to sort of reducing our uncertainty about, what are the possibilities for?
Yeah. Excellent question, actually. Yeah, so it is the unknown unknowns because, whenever we talk about new regimes, this is a fundamentally new regime that we as a field hadn't thought about before. Okay, this is all happening in just the last couple of years. So it's just a way of us being cautious to say that maybe there is some chemical pathway that we don't encounter on Earth or the solar system that we have missed, and we want to keep exploring, and maybe something will tell us that things are otherwise. So it's that kind of unknown unknown, rather than we knowing that, there is this aspect that we haven't been able to explore yet, so let's explore and find out. It's not that kind of thing. It's more the unknown unknown.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, that said, I will add that there are observational, this is like any cutting edge area of science, is that we want to develop testable hypotheses to rule out any false positives. And as I just mentioned, for this water loop, for example, you know, if you observe other planets which are slightly hotter, then maybe we can test that particular hypothesis. Similarly, you know, some of the biomarkers may be more stable at lower temperatures as opposed to higher temperatures. So again, when we observe populations of, I mean, population is a big word here, but even if we observe a handful of planets, two or three or four planets with different characteristics, different masses, radii, temperatures, and so on, by comparing them, by doing comparative characterization, we should be able to rule out some false positives. But it's all open. It's a very open ground right now. We're at the very edge of this area.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So it's getting pretty late, I think, for our speaker. I think it's like 9 p.m. or something over there. So let's stop here. So thanks again, Madhu, for your like fantastic, exciting talk. And thanks everyone else for coming. Everyone.
Neil, sorry, yeah. There was a question in the chat. Do you want me to take it?
Oh, sorry. I didn't. Okay, let me find it. So go ahead and answer.
Is the principal barrier to detecting biosignatures at the present related to limits of current telescope technology, or more so so it is the JWST allocation time. So we do have JWST. I mean, I'm leading multiple programs, two programs, and there are several other programs, which will observe some of these Haitian candidates. So we should be able to get the first hints of potential biomarkers if they're there. But beyond that, it's definitely for the community to come together and say, make a collective decision that let's invest more JWST time and focus on these objects and see whether they host life or not.